From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a former high-ranking CIA official talks about the root causes of ISIS.
Then director Gil Cates Jr. talks about making the new film, The Surface, on Lake Michigan.
Shooting on the lake, which was extremely challenging, exceeded my, just in terms of the challenges of shooting on water. I mean, I remember being out there and I would turn to Jimmy and I'd be like, man, how could anyone shoot a movie on land and think that's hard?
Essayist Alexandra Rosas remembers the immigrant experience around Halloween.
And the reality of performing in three different ballets twice in the same day.
Well, I was running between pieces. It was just kind of catch my breath, shake my muscles out, probably throw in some ibuprofen, take an inhaler, change costumes, and get back out.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news.
This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. Reports surfaced this week that the Obama administration is considering changing senior members of its foreign policy team after its troubled reactions to several crises.
The Ebola outbreak and the rise of the ISIS, or Islamic State movement, have taxed the United States' role as a world leader and have sparked criticism from people on both sides of the aisle in this country. But a leading foreign policy analyst believes the issue with ISIS extends to a point before President Obama took office.
Graham Fuller is a former vice chairman of the CIA's National Intelligence Council. He was in Milwaukee this week to talk about the Middle East, and he joined us in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. My pleasure, Mitch.
A number of people in recent days have pointed to a quote of yours that essentially lays the blame on the United States for making the rise of the Islamic State movement possible, if not likely. Why would you make that case?
Well, I think obviously we have to look back some years if we make that kind of claim. The Islamic State didn't come out. First of all, I don't really like the term Islamic State because it suggests that what we see with ISIS is what an Islamic State is or should be, and that's not, in the eyes of most Muslims, even what it should ever be. But ISIS, let's call it. I think it clearly was one of the products of growing out of the incredible chaos and destruction of Iraq and the collapse of the entire state structure. So in other words, if we hadn't gone to war in Iraq, I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that we would have ever had the phenomenon like ISIS in Iraq. But as we know, a good 500,000 people died in that war. There's a lot of rage and anger. The country's political system was turned upside down. The ruling Sunni minority was dislodged. The majority Shiites came to power, who then, out of their own anxieties, have not managed the place, at least for starters, terribly well, and somewhat discriminated against them. The infrastructure was destroyed. Probably 1.5 million people at least dislocated from their homes, both within Iraq and outside. So in other words, there were lots of reasons for anger and chaos to develop in Iraq, and ISIS is one of the outgrowths of that.
Is there anyone left in that region with any kind of leftover gratitude to the United States?
Well, that's a very difficult question to ask. I think American ideals are very valued still. I mean, people, Muslims and not just Muslims, I mean, people from around the world who come to the U.S. really appreciate the values as they see them lived in the United States and practiced by and large, although even that's beginning to weaken a bit. But I think the feeling over in that part of the world is that we don't really practice what we preach, and that in the last decade or more that the military instrument seems to be our preferred approach to solving problems of the Middle East, where I'd have to say I think they have exacerbated existing problems.
Would you say is there any appreciable difference between ISIS and the Taliban? Is this just another manifestation of the same phenomenon, the next generation of the Taliban, if you will?
Look, I think it's useful to think of Islam and political Islam as a broad spectrum. And you can't simply grab onto any one group and say that this is typical or characteristic. There is a huge range of people who see a role for Islamic values in politics. But that can range from extremely moderate and very democratically oriented views, such as the present ruling party in Turkey, to middle of the road Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and elsewhere that renounced violence quite some long time ago, 50 years ago. Then you can move on to places like Taliban and then to bin Laden. And who could have believed it? But the ISIS, which makes even bin Laden in some cases look moderate. Bin Laden's al-Qaeda has denounced ISIS for what they view as extreme and unnecessary and counterproductive violence. So the Taliban, I think, at least restored law and order to a totally anarchic post-war anarchic condition in Afghanistan and received some gratefulness for it. But it ran a very tough vigilante type state with pretty primitive Islamic values in itself. But no, I think this is not even a state structure.
Well, and you mentioned Turkey as an example of how Islam and politics can, if you will, peacefully coexist. Should we be looking at Turkey, both the West's relationship with Turkey and the management of that country, as an example for how we might apply our foreign policy in terms of other countries, whether it be Syria or Iraq?
Constant intervention, whether it's military or non-military, has been the hallmark of the West's relationship with the Middle East for a very long time, especially if you go back to colonial days when it was a matter of seizing oil or energy resources and putting in dictators that would be favorable to the West, pliable to the West, starting wars in the region. I don't want to say that there were not often reasons for unhappiness with what's going on, but they've been feeding off each other. So I think a withdrawal of American military forces as the primary instrument of international relations in the Middle East would be a great start. And yeah, Turkey, I mean, is quite a remarkable state. It's made huge progress in many respects, sort of stunning economic progress and otherwise. But you can't always expect that states that are successful and democratic and even balanced are necessarily going to like the United States or let me say like U.S. policies. And this is, I think, a difficulty that the U.S. is encountering now globally, that it's one thing to respect the United States' accomplishments, but you may not want to buy into American approach to every foreign issue, well, even friends.
And I wonder, you talk about the perhaps over-reliance on military intervention in the Middle East as one of the recurring errors of U.S. foreign policy. And I wonder whether one of the things that ISIS is really relying on is the continued military intervention to continue to sort of foment opposition to the United States. Are we really playing into their hands?
I think you put your finger on it there, Mitch. Definitely. This is part of – I mean, Muslims have felt for a long time that the desire of the West is to destroy Islam. I don't want to say most Muslims, but at least more radical Muslims are convinced that this is the U.S. agenda. And if you go back in history, it's not utterly unfounded. But sure, when ISIS in this hideous fashion beheaded on screen – Three sad victims, Western victims, you better believe they got the attention of the United States extremely quickly. This was – you talk about shock and awe. This was an Islamic form of shock and awe. They could have gone out, let's say, and mowed down 500 people in the desert in fighting or battles or seizing a city or village. Yeah, it would have been on the news and it would have been too bad, blah, blah. But when you do something like that, you grab the world's attention right away. And I think this has sadly served to radicalize even some young Muslims, even in the West, who have felt, boy, this is what ISIS would like. This is the moment of truth. This is the moment when we and the West have this ultimate standoff. And sadly, this does appeal to people who for one reason or another, buy into a radical vision of global politics.
Well, and so what would the likely result be if the U.S. decided to start pulling out, kind of, you know, unilaterally pulling out of the Middle East, militarily anyway?
Well, a lot of people are afraid that if the U.S. pulls out militarily that this would lead to chaos. I would argue that we've got massive chaos now with several wars underway in Afghanistan, Iraq. I hate to say it, but they've been losing wars. If they were working, it would be one thing, but they're losing wars, deeply costly. In the end, I think these peoples, these populations, this is globally, not just in the Middle East, have to start solving their own problems. When you have a U.S. military occupation in Iraq, say, the Shiites go to the United States and say, what are you going to do about the Sunnis? Or the Sunnis go to the – or the Kurds are going to come and say, what are you going to do about Baghdad? It's not our policy to be – it's not our role to be a referee in these cases, and invariably we get – we get blamed for failure to bring about solutions. So I think a little tough love. I mean, we went in and somewhat basically destroyed. Yes, we got rid of Saddam Hussein, who was not a very desirable ruler, for sure. But in the end, I think countries have to solve their own problems and learn to get along with each other. And they can and they will over time. But external intervention. I liken this sometimes to a mobile, you know, one of these things with all these hanging balls and everything. And I sort of sense that the U.S. is going in with the military and kind of grabbing onto a mobile and trying to, you know, stabilize it in a given situation. And then we let go and this mobile goes wild and everything, all the pieces fly all around. Ultimately, it has to reach some stability or stasis on its own, and I don't think we have facilitated that.
What about the idea of a moral obligation? When we see, you know, a dictator who is, in the case of Assad, really carrying out an assault on his own people, is there some place for the U.S. and the West to do something about that?
For a very long time, I had a lot of sympathy for the concept of exporting democracy and bringing it to the region. Sadly, over the years, I've had to conclude that I think U.S. policy is highly selective, if not even opportunistic in this regard. I'm sorry to say that. But we've been – there are good dictators if they like the U.S. There are bad dictators if they don't like the U.S. We believe in human rights, but where it serves our goals. I've sometimes said that democracy is a punishment that we deliver on our enemies but never a gift delivered to our friends, so that if you could have a Mubarak for 30 years in Egypt and much disliked by the people, but as long as he was friendly, we supported him. So in other words, it's highly consistent often very hypocritical, which destroys the credibility of these values. If we want to push democracy creation, let's turn to little countries that don't have the baggage who could – like Finland or, I don't know, Canada or Denmark or something like this that doesn't carry this massive geopolitical baggage that creates great suspicion about what our true goals are.
Well, and as you look at the situation in the Middle East today compared to where it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, this trajectory spans Republican and Democratic administrations.
That's absolutely right. And of course, the power of the Israeli lobby in Washington is legendary. It makes it very difficult even for rational discussion. I mean, the kinds of criticisms that you can read in the Israeli press about Israeli policy, nobody would dare reprint or publish or repeat in the United States. So we're being really more royal than the king in defending rather more extreme Israeli policies, I'd argue.
Well, it is a really tough nut to crack. Graham Fuller, thanks for helping us start anyway.
My pleasure, Mitch. Thanks for inviting me.
Graham Fuller is a former chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, a former senior political scientist at RAND, and currently teaches history at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. His most recent book is called Turkey and the Arab Spring: Leadership in the Middle East. Fuller was in Milwaukee to speak at an event organized by the Niagara Foundation.
Coming up next, four members of the team that produced a feature film on Lake Michigan think back on that challenging experience and the film that opens here tomorrow. We'll talk with them right after this. Lake Effect returns on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We spoke last year with a team shooting a major independent motion picture in Milwaukee starring Sean Astin.
The Surface is a drama about two men, both at a desperate point in their lives, who have a chance encounter on Lake Michigan. The film was shot just offshore and also on location in the city of Milwaukee. Now, nearly two decades after it was first conceived by Milwaukee writer Jeff Gendelman, the film is set to open tomorrow at Marcus Theaters on the North Shore and in Menominee Falls.
The film had its world premiere at the recent Milwaukee Film Festival, and just before that showing, we were joined by producer Jeff Gendelman, director Gil Cates Jr., cinematographer Jimmy Sammarco, and actor Chris Mulkey, who stars opposite Sean Astin as Kelly. Welcome to all of you.
It's nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Let me start with a question for Jeff and Gil here. The last time the two of you were here in this studio, The Surface was still mainly theoretical. You're working out locations, how it was all going to come together in a place that is not always geared towards large-scale film production. Can you talk about your expectations going in and whether the process lived up to those expectations?
This is Gil here, the red-haired one. I would say that it exceeded my expectations on all fronts in terms of just – it was a great collaborative effort. And I don't know if exceed is the word, but shooting on the lake – which was extremely challenging, I would say, exceeded my, you know, just in terms of the challenges of shooting on water. I mean, I remember being out there and I would turn to Jimmy and I'd be like, man, how could anyone shoot a movie on land and think that's hard? Like, shoot on land. I'll go shoot anything right now. What do you want to shoot? You want to shoot a movie in a restaurant? Let's go. This is hard. But it exceeded it in a good way because it, you know, in terms of the actors, like it really felt – we were out there, you know, and you can't fake that. The water was shaking the boat and things were happening. So the whole process was a one-of-a-kind experience.
Well, yeah. So let's talk about shooting on water here because it's not something that, you know, obviously the average person doesn't, you know, when they see a film, they don't have any idea what it takes to make a film look authentic out on the water. Is there a certain – trying to roll with the punches but at the same time control your environment?
I'll take that first and then I'll give it to Jimmy. Under Gil's deft direction and Jimmy's brilliant cinematography, the film worked really well because Jimmy, as a co-producer, was able to bring on all of these wonderful people in the southeastern Wisconsin area who are in the film crew. The world, and they all know him and love him. Someone told me, a couple of people the last year told me that over 90% of the people working in film worked on The Surface last summer. And a lot of that is because of Jimmy. They know him, they know his talent, and they want to work with him. And the fact that it was a feature film shooting in Milwaukee, which is very rare, that was also important. But he was able to bring all that talent. Now, because it was in development for so many years, I knew that we had to learn from the masters, like Steven Spielberg shooting Jaws, the people who did Waterworld, Open Water, etc. So we had to learn the lessons learned from those people. But understanding those were also large budgets. This was not going to be a large budget film. So we had to have a plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, plan E. And we ended up going with plan F and closer to plan G. So he started doing the process of understanding how to do this difficult task of being on a great lake, which is more dangerous than the Atlantic or the Pacific because it has unpredictable currents, of which we all experienced last summer because of the wind shifts and the shifting currents. It made boat anchoring extremely difficult. And I'll give the mic to Jimmy.
Well, Jimmy, can you ever hope to control your environment while you're doing something like this in a place like Lake Michigan?
No, not in the lake. The lake's going to do what it's going to want to do, and the weather's going to do what it wants to do, and we just have to hope and pray that we get the weather we need. And luckily, we did. I mean, the weather wasn't really the issue; it was the winds. We could spend, you know, one day it took us an hour and a half to get our boats anchored and our camera boats anchored, picture boats set. One day it took us 8 hours. And then when we finally got set, the waves went from 1 to 3 feet, and we were done. We had to go inside the break wall. It took a lot of listening to documentaries behind the scenes of Jaws and seeing how they shot it. I think Red October, I studied some of the notes on that.
You went to Hawaii to meet with
Alan. Actually, I did, yeah. I went to Hawaii on a family trip, and I just happened to ask Gil, do you happen to know the DP from Hawaii Five-O? He's like, well, in fact, that DP, Alan Queso, his first professional job was for Gil's dad. So Gil called him up and set up the meeting, and we sat and talked. And, you know, he had confirmed what I'd read about Jaws and other films, that you really have to shoot it handheld for the most part. But before that, actually, when Jeff gave me the script, I worked on a film a couple years ago called Song Sung Blue. And a guy by the name of Garrett Brown, his wife, was on that film as a producer. Garrett Brown is the inventor of the Steadicam. So I emailed Garrett, said, do you have any idea how to shoot on water? And he brought up this, he told me about this device called the Perfect Horizon. Basically, you sit it on top of a tripod. And yes, it goes up and down with the waves, but your horizon stays level. And so I looked it up, and it was like $5,000 a day. I'm like, well, there's no way we're going to do that. Well, when I got closer to actually shooting the film, I looked into it again, and I found this guy in L.A. who was a subleaser of the device, and he gave it to us for a fraction of that. And he actually brought an extra one for no charge. And it was just so into the project and the story and wanted to be a part of it that he really helped us out. And so some of the wider shots, boat to boat, we did a lot of Perfect Horizon stuff. So it's a combination of the Perfect Horizon device and a lot of handheld work.
Gil Cates Jr., do you, when you're directing something like this and there's so much unpredictability about what the lake is going to look like and feel like, do you have to at some level think the finished product could look like A, B, C, or D?
Definitely. I mean, there were times where we would shoot and then we'd get back to shore and I'd want to go see right away what it looked like, because I want to be with the actors as much as I can, not staring at a monitor. But with this movie, it was so hard not to want to look at the monitor, because I didn't want it to be, you know, what's the Woody Allen movie with all the Steadicam, you know, Husbands and Wives? I forgot which one that's like known for being extreme. I didn't want it to be like that. And some of the footage I saw, you know, you could see the boat rocking up and down, and I was nervous at one point. I said to Jimmy, I said, man, I'm nervous that this is going to be unwatchable. In terms of obviously not anything other than just it's so bouncy. But it actually worked out really well. And I give a lot of the credit to Jimmy and a lot of the credit to, of course, the actors. And we controlled as much as we could. We made hard decisions at times, when to stop, when to go. But it came together. I don't think there's – my fear did not come to fruition that it was – because it could – and the one scene that is very bouncy is so apropos to what's going on in that moment. It actually works really well. So I think you'd actually think we rocked the boat for that scene. But it's a high conflict scene between the two guys. So yeah, it was definitely a little bit of, you know, preparation and hope.
Was it a challenge from a continuity standpoint that you know, if you're shooting part of a scene and the waves are going in a certain way and the wind is going in a certain way, you got to finish the scene because you might have completely different conditions the next time you're shooting?
Big time. And we were fortunate enough to be able to shoot two cameras a lot of the time, which helped. And also, and not just the waves, the sun, because, you know, when you're shooting on a stage or in a restaurant or some practical location, you can control the lights. It's very easy. Here, it's like, hey, God, can you move it to the left? You know, there's no, there's only so wide you can go with these flags and things. So
I want to bring Chris Mulkey into the conversation here. You are one of the leads in the film, and you are actually a Wisconsin native, if I'm not mistaken.
I was born in Viroqua, Wisconsin. It doesn't roll off your tongue. It's a great little town. It's over by Eau Claire.
Kind of the hub of the organic farming world in this state, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's in New Rhineland area. My dad owned a hardware store there. You could come in and buy a gun and a toaster. It was good.
Do you get any kind of professional satisfaction out of being able to make a feature film here, even being from the other part of the state?
Yeah, I like the Midwest a lot. I own a house in the Twin Cities, and I love coming to the Midwest, and Milwaukee is such a great place to work. And, I mean, one of my writing partners called the Midwest the Decency Belt, and where people show up and things work out. To this film, you know, this is a film about two guys trying to survive in the middle of Lake Michigan, and I had really great fears that this wasn't going to work out because of the difficulty of shooting on water. Oh my God! I mean, we did, and I'm not supposed to say this, but. Mitch, but because we're such good friends and you ate some of my donuts before I came in here. But after we finished shooting the entire movie, we went in into the marina and anchored it. And then Gil had Sean and I do the entire movie as a play in the boat. It was great. I mean, that's the first time I'd ever done that, and I've done 80 films. It felt so comfortable with Sean as an actor that we could just go ahead and do it, and it was great.
I'm sure in the dozens of films you've made, you've worked on sound stages and worked in situations like this. What do you get out of being really in the place where the film is supposed to be taking place versus being in a generic soundstage or a more controlled environment?
Being in the actual physical place where the story happens is why I'm doing films instead of plays. I mean, I still do plays, but I get great satisfaction of creating a reality in a natural environment, and you can't get more natural than Lake Michigan, yo.
I think that is actually Milwaukee's new slogan.
Yeah. I have the T-shirt. It's on the bumper of my pickup truck.
Were there aspects to the story itself that especially resonated with you that made you want to be a part of this project?
Yeah, I'm a lake guy. I have a lake house in northern Minnesota. I'm a surfer, and I'm a huge water guy. And it always intrigues me. And I stowed away to France on a ship when I was 19. And so I've been on the water a bunch and in fraught situations. Some of them I created, of course. But it drew me to the dilemma of what do you do when, you know, when the chips are completely down, and like these two characters are, you know, the chips are down, and you have to show up and figure a way out. And that always attracts me, you know. Plus, some of it's funny too. Sean's hilarious too. Oh my God, it's great.
Yeah,
it's fraught.
Jeff, and maybe Jimmy too, is there a carryover effect to this, would you hope, beyond the subversive message about, you know, our freshwater economy here? Would you hope that the success of this film might pave the way for other projects of this size and scope in and around Wisconsin?
I would hope so. I think for it to happen, though, you know, you're going to need someone who's a brave, fearless filmmaker like Jeff to get it done. Because unless, you know, maybe if we got our tax incentives back, that would help. But really, Jeff took a ginormous risk making this movie, and a lot of this is on his shoulders, you know. And by a lot, I mean 99%. And it was such a blessing how this film evolved from Jeff and I just talking about it, how we're going to shoot this with, you know, two 5D cameras, to all of a sudden we get blessed with Gil's presence on this movie, which was terrific. I mean, and then Gil brings Chris and Sean in, and it was just all of a sudden we went from, you know, this tiny little film to this terrific project.
Yeah, I read the script, you know, and I think it was down in Houston. I was doing a fundraiser with Donald Driver, you know, Green Bay Packer. I'm known him.
I'm familiar with his work. Yes.
Yeah, and I got the script. I read it when I was down there, and I went. I don't know how I can do this because I'm down in Houston, but I gotta meet Gil on this movie. This is fantastic. And so I flew in early in the morning, and that night I was going to play at the 4th of July. We had 10,000 people at the Santa Monica Stadium, football stadium. And so I had between me flying in and sound check, I had like an hour and a half to meet Gil. And I raced to Beverly Hills, and I said, dude, I want to do this movie, okay? If you don't hire me, at least hire somebody who is a water guy, okay? Because you don't want a whiner on the water. And so, I couldn't whine when we did the film. It wasn't too bad, but it's a great script that Jeff crafted, and it was really exciting to be part of it that way.
Well, being in the field of entertainment, I was always focused on having it shot in Milwaukee. And through the years, as I would interview different directors and different producers and different stars, nobody wanted to do it in Milwaukee for many reasons. They would rather do it in Florida or New Jersey or Canada.
I hear Vancouver's nice.
Yeah. Baja, California. So a lot of reason why it took so long to make, that was my choice. Because I was really focused on making sure this benefited the Milwaukee area.
We're having this conversation on the morning of the festival premiere of this film. It has been a part of your life for now almost 20 years. Is it a little surreal that there will be an audience and a theater and people watching it?
I am so excited!
It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Well, how many seats are at 1,200?
Yeah.
They're all sold out?
Yeah.
You know?
And Chris and Gil were talking last night about all the films that they've been – Gil's done 10 movies that he's directed.
Between Chris and I, we've done 90.
90 movies. They've never seen any of their films in a theater this size.
What are your hopes for it? Where does it go from its screening in Milwaukee? Is it going to do the festival circuit? Is it getting wider distribution? What's the plan?
The ultimate goal, if you are an audience member and you're on the top of your game and life is going great and you're 14 years of age and older.
Take to your Twitter feed.
Right. This film's for you. If you are having a bad day, a bad week, a bad month, a bad year, and you're really depressed, maybe even suicidal, this film's for you because it will entertain you and inspire you. Mm-hmm. The film will have an exclusive rollout, if you will, by virtue of Marcus Theaters, and that'll start October 31st. From there, it'll do a slow rollout throughout the Midwest. And then I would say the beginning of the year, our hopes are it'll be in Los Angeles and many other communities in the art house circuit throughout the states. And then further down the road, obviously, video on demand, DVD, internet download, Netflix. But we're also positioned for foreign nicely. That'll play well around the world.
Jeff, Jimmy, Gil, and Chris, congratulations and thank you so much for spending some time with us, and best of luck as this goes forward.
Thanks.
Appreciate
so much.
It. Thanks, Mitch.
Appreciate it. Actor Chris Mulkey stars in the role of Kelly in the film The Surface. It opens tomorrow at the Marcus North Shore Cinema and Marcus Menominee Falls.
It's directed by Gil Cates Jr. and was written and produced by Jeff Gendelman. Jimmy Sammarco was cinematographer. You'll find our previous interviews about the film at wuwm.com/lakeeffect.
A short break now, and then we'll have a remembrance of Halloween's past, where cultures overlapped but didn't quite mesh. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Although some towns in the area have already celebrated their Halloween, tomorrow marks the actual All Hallows' Eve. But no matter when you trick-or-treat, the point is for kids to wear the coolest costumes and to see who can amass the fullest bag of high-fructose corn syrup goodness.
Unless you are newly arrived in this country and your parents don't quite get the cultural importance of trick-or-treat, as Lake Effect essayist Alexandra Rosas remembers.
There the four of us stood, the hobo with the 5 o'clock shadow, the circus clown with the red SOS pad hair tuffets, Casper, not just friendly but cute ghost, and the bumbling Fred Flintstone. My Colombian family had not been in this country long enough to understand the essential childhood nuances of Halloween trick-or-treat in the 1960s, especially for a girl. Things like my trick-or-treat night dream list, which stated that my costume will be homemade and glittery and have some netting somewhere, better yet, everywhere, with my trick-or-treat candy bag also homemade and glittery and matching my costume. Or my please, dear God, basics list, outlining that my costume will fit me, that my costume is one for a girl, since I'm a girl, and importantly, that I should be able to go with friends and not all of my siblings instead. And my Colombian child's Lourdes Kill Me Now list, spelling out clearly that I should not be sent out into the dark night with a plastic baggie full of pennies so I can pay the person giving out the candy so that no one can say I took candy from them. I should not have to go trick-or-treating with my non-English-speaking parents only 5 feet away asking 100 times, ¿Qué es eso? What is that? For every candy I get, so that I end up translating for both sides, the giver and the getter, explaining what I got to who gave it to me, not knowing who the heck wants to know what anymore. My parents did not understand trick-or-treat, and as painful as it was to go along with all the non-Americanisms they threw into it, my siblings and I begged to be allowed to join the neighborhood children on this most exciting of nights. Trick-or-treat in the late 60s went on in pitch-black nights. We explained to our mother that we would need costumes. Times back then were charming. Costumes were sold at local five and dime stores, boxed with a cellophane peek hole so you could see what was inside. As my parents were out buying our costumes on Halloween Day, we watched and waited for the return. All four of us squeezed against our front room window. Oh, the hope that we still had, that somehow our mother and father would come through for us and walk in with alter egos of our dreams. When they came home, we attacked them at the door, diving into the Ben Franklin craft shop bag. We held up the four boxes and stared at the masks looking up at us from their cozy see-through homes. The hollow-eyed plastic faces staring back at us were no one we wanted to spend time being. Our choices for the night were Mr. Cigar-Chomping Hobo Man, white-faced Bozo the Clown with blood-red cream puffs for hair, Casper, and last, the frightfully inappropriate bulky Fred Flintstone. Where was Snow White? Where was Superman? Where was Cinderella? All I could think was, God in heaven, why is this my life? Followed by what I've been saying to myself for years by that point. Oh, well, let's just do this. Would it surprise you if I told you that the only costume that fit me was Fred Flintstone? At least we wouldn't be fighting over the least mentally harmful image, cute dimple-cheeked Casper. He came home in size 4T and just right for my little sister. We suited up, pulling up the pre-flame retardant regulation nylon costumes that would instantly take you from Little Red Riding Hood to the superhero Human Torch if you got anywhere near a parent's lit cigarette. My Spanish grandmother shook her head, muttering the words, trick-or-tree, trick-or-tree, and sighing about the silliness of it all as she tied the strings at the top of our costumes in a double knot. Does anyone remember those stiff plastic masks with the skinniest of elastic bands stapled into place, with barely any room for a European-sized nose behind it? Does anyone remember the way your hot breath would turn the non-breathable plastic into a Scandinavian steam room within seconds of stepping out into the cold night? This was after dark, in late October. While your hands and toes and ears were freezing, your face would be getting a Moisture Beauty Hot Springs treatment, and those half-inch horizontal eye slits cut into the masks as a lie that they would allow vision? I still remember looking down and getting my eyelashes caught in the sharp plastic edges. Years later, looking at a picture of us on this night, I see us lined up, tallest to cutest, right before we left the house. Fred, me, Hobo, brother, Bozo, the other brother, and cute Casper, baby sister. I look at this picture and remember the feeling of resignation to my lot in life. Equal parts anger mixed with despair. Fred Flintstone. What if someone in a lovingly handmade pink sparkly princess costume from school saw me as Fred Flintstone? Not only was I store-bought, but I was gender mismatched, too. If only that were where the story stopped. We were then sent out into the night with that bag of pennies. Why? Because we lived by the Colombian motto, expect revenge from everyone and give no one a reason to say you owe them something. Ding dong, trick or treat, it's your Colombian connection. Can I give you a penny for that peanut butter twist? I've got a bag full here.
Lake Effect essayist Alexandra Rosas is a contributing author of the Her Stories Project, as well as other anthologies. She's also a Milwaukee Grand Slam story champion for The Moth, and she lives with her family in Cedarburg.
We'll take one last break and then return with part four of our week-long series that takes us behind the scenes with the next generation of professional ballet dancers. Stay tuned. Lake Effect, we'll be right back. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
All this week, we're airing a series that goes backstage with the next generation of ballet dancers.
Contributing producer Lucian Jung spent the past year following dancers in the Milwaukee Ballet's second company. These dancers, known as MB2s, are part of a demanding year-long training program that's intended to transform them into professionals.
At this stage of the series, it's the midpoint of the program. The dancers face an increasingly hectic schedule as they head into audition season.
Following a demanding holiday schedule loaded with community outreach events and back-to-back performances of The Nutcracker, the MB2s had a short break. Now it's January. They've returned to a city crippled by sub-zero temperatures and must prepare for one of the most important performances of their season, the MB2 Showcase at the South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center.
We've had a really, really busy couple weeks.
Allison Chavez is the Community Outreach Director at the Milwaukee Ballet.
The dancers got back on January 6th, well, they were supposed to get back from winter break, but thanks to the polar vortex, we really were put behind. And then there was a bunch of them who were stranded in cities literally all over the world. This is their big main stage show of the season. You know, losing 2 days of 6 to 8 hours of rehearsal is huge.
There's little time for the dancers, choreographers, and tech crew to get in sync. But second-year MB2 Garrett Glassman is taking it all in stride.
We are in the middle of tech rehearsal, so no costumes at the moment or makeup. We're just kind of marking through for spacing since this is the first time we've been on stage with any of these pieces. So they're just testing lights and sound, and right now we're working with Petter's piece, which is the Cole Porter piece, and we're just kind of waiting to be told to dance.
In addition to Petter Zaradnicek's piece, the showcase also features a work by fellow choreographer-in-residence Timothy O'Donnell.
We need to just smooth off our partnering. It's got very footy. I know, like, first time I say it, just watch it. Does it get to that first section? Pretty good. Just, I got very concerned throughout all of that with marking that you were marking so off the counts. It's the first time I've ever seen that section with you two not be spot on with the partnering. Like, terrifies me.
5 minutes, gentlemen.
I need a ticket for this afternoon's performance.
The show is ideal for dance lovers and novices alike. It showcases a range of styles from classical to contemporary.
Enjoy the show.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
This was just unbelievably good.
We like the classical. We like the classical ballet, but not the others.
Too much modern dance.
It was a nice variety of modern and traditional.
The MB2's high level of skill and artistry was on full display during the South Milwaukee Showcase. The dancers performed beautifully, an impressive feat considering the chaotic scene leading up to the show. In addition to lost rehearsal time, the dancers had to contend with a slippery floor and the pressure of doing two performances in one day, a challenge for Garrett Glassman, who was in 3 of the 5 pieces.
While I was running between pieces, it was just kind of catch my breath, shake my muscles out, probably throw in some ibuprofen, take an inhaler, change costumes, and get back out.
Garrett was one of the showcase's featured dancers. This offered him the opportunity to impress a really important member of the audience, Milwaukee Ballet's artistic director.
Did you know that Michael Pink was going to be in the audience?
I did, yeah.
What does that mean for you guys?
Well, I mean, 10 of the company dancers and that out of 24 are graduates of the MB2 program, and so MB2s have a better chance of getting a job here than anyone else who's auditioning. This is the MB2's big moment. You know, this is where we're most exposed on a real stage, you know, for a real audience with difficult choreography and things that should be able to say, hey, I'm ready for a professional contract.
So this is your first, second company experience.
Yeah.
My sense is that there are all of these great dancers that just aren't any openings. How long do you wait? How do you navigate those choices?
I mean, I'll find out very soon if I'm going to be in that position or not. But, I can imagine it's got to be pretty difficult to wait that long. I mean, being in a second company is a lot of work. It's not just rehearsing and dancing and doing class. You know, you have all the outreach, you know, extra hours that you have to put in. I don't know if it's how badly you want it or not, or if you need to lower your standards, because a lot of these dancers who are being put on hold are extremely talented, and if they were to audition for a company that wasn't as well known or didn't have as big of a budget or didn't perform on as big of a stage for as big of an audience, you know, they can get a job and be a principal in those companies, but they don't want to settle for that. They want to be in a company surrounded by artists who are better than they are.
The reluctance to settle is rooted in a dancer's drive for perfection, a goal that often makes Garrett his own toughest critic.
I haven't had a performance yet that I've walked off and been 100% satisfied with every second of it. I mean, there's always something that you would have wanted to go better. You know, when you're taking class every day, you don't spend your entire class watching Andrea, you know, or somebody else. You're watching yourself. I mean, that's the hardest part. We're spending an hour and a half of class watching ourselves in the mirror, and then 6 hours of rehearsals watching yourself in the mirror to make sure everything looks right. So it's a lot of looking at yourself and judging yourself, and you obsess over, you know, every flaw that you have.
The stress of the winter performance schedule, made worse by the frigid cold of the polar vortex, is starting to take its toll on the MB2s at a time when they need to be at their best. Audition season is about to begin, and for the most talented dancers, company contracts are in the offing.
This group is very strong.
Rolando Yanez is the director of the MB2 program.
In the past 2 or 3 years, we have been a strong group, but this year it seems like every dancer has something to offer.
This makes securing a professional contract with the Milwaukee Ballet even tougher. MB2 artistic staff Murray Favarel and Carl von Robinow have seen firsthand what happens when anxiety over an uncertain future becomes paralyzing.
There's a patience that a dancer has to have as hard as they work towards their goal. They also have to be aware of what's happening around them, because we have a tendency to be incredibly tunnel vision individuals. We know where we're going, we know what we want. It's sometimes we get lost on how do we get there.
Those are usually the students we spend the most time with. And those that have the trouble to connect things and walk so hard. And sometimes they walk so hard that their brain shut off. They're just wanting it so much that something happens there that they're not open to what we're saying.
Even in this group, we still have some dancers that have a lot of talent, but they are not ready. And, you know, when they perform and they still are not there, you see that there's a lot of things that they need to work and issues with their body and self-confidence and things like that.
But if the talent is there, if the work ethic is there, and they're really, that's how we made the decision, let's keep them one more year.
At Milwaukee Ballet, the decision on who will be offered a contract is made by its inscrutable artistic director, Michael Pink. But the first consideration is how many contracts will be available, and that depends on the number of company dancers that come back for another season.
We don't know, because they give the letters to the dancers, and then it all depends of if the dancers are returning or not returning, if it has contract, and I think that happened at the end of April.
It's really late
the dancers already.
That's why we encourage them to go and audition, not wait for that to happen, but go to audition in other companies so they have a plan B in case there is no spot in the company.
But this year's group of 20 MB2s don't have time to sit and agonize. They still have a full slate of community outreach events that includes demos at area hospitals, museums, libraries, and senior centers, as well as a tour of grade schools and high schools with The Superheroes Show, an educational dance program that teaches kids about ballet. Amid all this, they receive exciting news. The South Milwaukee performance was such a resounding success that for the first time ever, artistic director Michael Pink invites the MB2s to join the Milwaukee Ballet in its Contemporary Ballet Showcase, Winter Series at the Pabst Theater.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. The piece that you've just seen was performed by an extremely talented second. It was a few weeks back that I went to a recital program that this wonderful group of dancers put together, and I was so impressed. I thought it was very important to share it with you so that you can see the next generation.
For 17-year-old Katie Manger, life in a second company has been a lot more challenging than she expected. But experiences like the Winter Series put everything into perspective.
I was shocked to be the first MB2s ever to be asked in Winter Series. I still can't believe it. I really can't.
Were you more nervous going into the Pabst performance than, say, the South Milwaukee performance?
Way more nervous. Way more nervous. We're in a theater that I've never been before, so the lights were different, the depth of the stage was different, the floor was different, so...
How many rehearsals before the first one?
Just one. Just one dress rehearsal, so that also made me nervous, too. And... during the weekend, we had some people get really, really sick, and they were some of the leads of our piece.
Marie Varlet was one of the featured dancers in Timothy O'Donnell's piece, At World's End.
I got a really bad stomach flu during this weekend.
You still performed all the...
Yeah, I didn't perform the Friday night because I was really sick, and they didn't want to put me on stage. But I did the Saturday night and Sunday night, and I got 2 days off after, so...
Did you want to go perform on Friday?
Oh, yeah, I want to do it. I loved it too much. I was like, and it's such, like, a chance to perform like this. I didn't want to let it go.
And then did you watch it or did you stay home?
I watched. Yeah, it was hard. But the thing is, like, my best friend here got to do it. So I was really happy for her. It was such a good opportunity for her to do it.
Being in a piece like End of World, does that help you professionally to have him choreograph that on you?
Yeah, a lot. Okay. It's a big part of my video.
Okay. Where are you planning on auditioning?
I went to Denver for Colorado Ballet, and it went actually pretty well. So it just depends if they have, like, contracts, but they liked me. So I might get something there. But I'm actually might go to New York this weekend to try Cincinnati Ballet.
Well, what should every single one of you in the ME2 program know how to do if you want to get a contract?
I mean, in the company, you never know what they're looking for. If they're looking for someone that can turn a lot, or someone that's really flexible, or someone, like, super skinny, or, like, you really don't know. So just, like, show your best and your smile.
What does every single person need to do?
Show our personalities.
But what do you see some people just getting wrong?
Usually what I don't like is, like, people thinking only about, like, oh my gosh, I need to do 3 periods. I need to do more so I can get a job. And I think that's really stupid. Just, like, be yourself.
And maybe it's just your personality, but I never get the sense that you're ever stressed out.
Well, me neither, actually. And when I got sick, I think it's because I keep everything somewhere and, like, at the moment just explode.
For Marie Varlet and the MB2's other international students, a first company contract means starting a new life as a professional dancer in the United States. But that's only if the company can secure an employment visa. This is another cause for concern during the stressful audition season. But nothing comes easily for those who pursue this career. And oftentimes, it's the one with the most stamina who makes it to center stage.
Contributor Lucian Jung produced our series on the Nancy Einhorn Milwaukee Ballet 2 program. The fifth part of our series will air tomorrow, and you can catch up on any episodes you missed on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Mitch Teich. Before we go, we want to make sure we give a fond goodbye to somebody who has been an integral part of the Lake Effect team for just about 2 years now. Eleanor Peterson joined the team as an intern. She stuck with us for a long time as a production assistant, and she has basically done yeoman's work, keeping our heads above water, editing things, and we will miss her a great deal.
We certainly will. Best of luck in all future endeavors, Eleanor, and stay in touch. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you as always for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air comes your way next.